Session number 4410, reel number 4.
Sir John Glubb, reel 1. Could you tell me, Sir John, about the work you were involved in the early 30s, the diplomatic work concerning the good neighbourly relations between Transjordan and Saudi Arabia?
Yes, certainly. I was all the frontiers of Transjordan with Saudi Arabia were in the desert. And I was at the time what was called commander of the desert area, which was really both the administrator and controller of the deserts of Transjordan. And consequently, I was made also in frontier liaison with the Saudi Arabians. And opposite me, Ibn Saud appointed a similar inspector of the frontier on his side, who was a man called Abdulaziz ibn Zayd. And he and I used to meet quite frequently and really became quite friends. And that was the key to the fact, I think, that there never was any more shooting or raiding or incidents on the Transjordan-Saudi Arabian frontier. I think I said before, the last one was in 1932. Thereafter, everything was always at peace because he and I were at a very good understanding.
Why do you think that they chose someone with a military post such as you had with the Arab Legion for what seems to have been a diplomatic job?
Well, merely because I was there. All the frontier was in my area. Nobody else went into the desert at all, and I was solely in control of the desert. And any incidents that might have occurred would have involved the tribes which I was supposed to control. There was really nobody else in Transjordan who had any knowledge or experience or control over those tribes.
Was the fact that you weren't an Arab yourself of any disadvantage to you in that work, or do you think that it might have been an advantage in some ways?
Well, I don't think either, really, but since the First World War, even in the times of the Turks, the ruling classes in the Middle East were largely, if not Europeanized, they wished to be Europeanized and were educated rather on imitation European lines, which, as I say, was the policy of the Ottoman Empire during its last 50 years. And far from being interested in tribes, the official classes looked upon them with distaste as being out of date and rather disgraceful, and knew nothing about them, in fact made a point, rather, of not knowing anything about them. I've had, both in Iraq and Jordan, senior Arab local officials ask me to interpret between them and a Bedouin tribesman. In both cases, I think this was a slight affectation, but it was rather smart not to be able to understand these terrible backward savages. And the result is there were no claimants and no aspirants on the Transjordan side for a job involving Bedouin incidents.
Did it occasion any surprise then that you, as a Westerner, should have been in such close contact, such willing close contact with the Bedouin tribes, whom the type of person whom you've been describing, who had the aspirations to westernization, looked down on so much?
Yes, well, periodically, I mean, so they used to say to me, why on earth do you take an interest in these terrible people? But I think most people more or less acquiesce. Another thing was, of course, that as a result of my being in charge of the desert, incidents committed by Bedouins ceased. Whereas before I arrived there, the Transjordan government had not attempted to control their tribes. And the tribes occasionally robbed passers-by and created incidents on villages along the fringe of the desert. And when all such incidents of disorder ceased, the official class in Transjordan realized, they appreciated, and they've often said to me at the time, thank you very much, this is fine now, we don't have any trouble with these people anymore.
What was your reply when they said to you, why on earth do you take such an interest in these people?
Oh, I don't know what I said, really. I suppose I said, oh, well, I just got interested in them. Well, it was an accident originally, an accident in Iraq, when there happened to be an incident in an area in which I was working, and I became involved, and thereafter that led to further employment in desert areas.
Could you tell me what the Bedouin Control Board was?
Yes, that was an arrangement, or a control board, as you say, of which the president was the Emir Sharqa, who was a cousin of the Emir Abdullah, who of course was the ruler of Transjordan. And this was established before my arrival in Jordan. But as the Bedouin Control Board had no forces in the desert, its control was rather fictitious. All they could do, which was really the old Turkish method, was to wait until nomadic tribes came into the settled or cultivated areas, which they used to do in summer, and then try and round up or something, or seize the value of anything they were accused of having robbed. But when I began, I was made a member of the Bedouin Control Board with the Emir Sharqa. Emir Sharqa was a most remarkable man, a tremendous personality. He'd lived all his life in the Hejaz until Ibn Saud conquered the Hejaz, and he joined Emir Abdullah, Transjordan. But he was, one might almost say, nature's gentleman. At the beginning, he was a little doubtful about my arrival, but we also became tremendous friends after a short time. And we just worked hand to hand. He lived always in Amman. He only once came out with me and did a little trip into the desert. But where action was necessary, I worked with him. I told him what we'd done and what had happened and so on. Then, at a fairly early date, which I can't remember now, he died. After which the Bedouin Control Board automatically petered out. It had been really based on his personality before.
Why was he doubtful about you at first?
Well, purely, I think, because I was British and he'd lived all his life in the Hejaz or Transjordan, which are rather backward tribal areas, and he didn't know how an Englishman was going to handle this. As soon as we got to know each other, we worked hand in glove.
So he stayed most of his time in the capital, Amman,
yes,
whilst you were doing the field work, as it
That's
were.
Right, yes.
Earlier on, you were speaking about your work with the Arab Legion in dealing with the consequences for Transjordan of the Arab revolt in Palestine in the later 30s. Could you tell me what was the attitude of your men in the Arab Legion towards these rebels?
Well, they were, I suppose you'd say, rebels. Anyhow, the Arab Legion was absolutely loyal and well-disciplined. And, of course, it was in the advantageous position of not being imperial troops or British troops or anything to do with them. It was the army of Transjordan. Consequently, it was merely like police in any country who were handling their own subjects. There was no question of foreign interference or anything. And when the Transjordan government agreed to prevent these gangs using Transjordan as a base to attack Palestine, the Arab Legion, which was the army of Transjordan, automatically took its orders, and with no feeling of guilt about being serving foreigners or anything like that, they were the army of Transjordan doing their duty.
But do you think that they had sympathy with what the insurgents or whatever, gangs or whatever you might call them, were trying to do in view of the situation in Palestine? Or were they ignorant about the politics behind it, or what?
As troops or police, they never showed any hesitation or doubts or anything like that. Of course, everybody, including the Emir Abdullah, sympathized with the position in Palestine. But it wasn't for the army to reason why, was it?
What were the main problems for the Arab Legion in suppressing this situation?
Well, the situation, the position really was that these people infiltrated into Ajloun, which is a mountainous area with considerable forests on it. And the gangs used to descend upon some isolated village who were afraid of these armed men and were obliged to supply them with food and everything else they needed. Not that the villagers wanted the gangs to be there, but they couldn't defend themselves against them. So that the villagers themselves were delighted when troops and police arrived, because it protected them from blackmail from the gangs.
In this situation, the war clouds were gathering in Europe. Did that affect the Arab Legion in any way, as far as the number of troops you were taking on was concerned, or the equipment which you had, or the role which the Arab Legion was adopting?
No, it didn't at all. It is rather amusing to remember now that when war broke out, the Emir Abdullah cabled the British government and said that he and the resources of his principality were at the disposition of the Western Allies. And the British government, in its wisdom, replied, "Thank you very much, but this war will only be limited to Europe, and there will be no repercussions in the Middle East, and therefore no steps are necessary in your part of the world." The reason for this confidence was that the agreement between Britain and France was that France should maintain a large army in Syria and Britain in Egypt. And the two of them were confident that they could keep the Middle East quiet. What hadn't been reckoned on is that France should be defeated and surrender and begin to cooperate with the Nazis. When that happened, then that large French army in Syria, on which the Allies had relied to keep order in that part of the world, suddenly became a Nazi instrument. And a German-Italian commission arrived in Syria. The French High Commissioner remained, but he had this Italo-German commission sitting at his elbow, telling him what to do. So that all of a sudden, as I say, this large French army, which is on our side, was on the other side. Then, I can't remember exact dates offhand, one day General Wavell, who was Commander-in-Chief in the Middle East, and Anthony Eden, who I think was Secretary of State for War, arrived from Egypt by air in Amman, and they saw the Emir Abdullah and said, "For heaven's sake, can you raise any soldiers? Because we haven't got any to stand up to the French in Syria, who are now on the other side." And that was the first time after the fall of France when suddenly complete reversal of policy, having been told there was nothing we could do to help. We were suddenly asked to do everything possible to help because there were no soldiers. Unfortunately, at that stage of the war, it was impossible to get anything. Britain was recreating an army at home, had no weapons, hadn't enough weapons for herself. We had no vehicles. No vehicles were obtainable from Britain. And so, actually, I cabled direct to the Ford Company in Detroit and asked them to ship a load of Ford trucks by sea.
To which port would that be?
To Haifa. Which they did. But shortly afterwards, we ordered a second consignment of trucks and the ship was torpedoed in the Atlantic, and that was that. However, we did acquire a certain number of commercial Ford trucks, because the British government, while asking us to raise soldiers, could give neither weapons nor vehicles. As the British Army was the most suitable, we'll say, to fight in inhabited areas, town and village areas, the special role which they asked of the Arab Legion was to look after the Syrian desert. And for this reason, we raised the 1st Regiment of mechanized infantry, who were carried in these Ford trunks we got from Detroit. We had a few machine guns already, and eventually, as British units in the Middle East were re-equipped with Bren guns, for example, we were allowed to have Lewis guns, which were First World War weapons, and even Hotchkiss guns, which were even older. So we raised this improvised regiment, as I say, equipped with cast-off automatic weapons from the British Army and commercial Ford trucks. Well, then, in the spring of 1941, Iraq underwent a coup d'etat. Four army generals took over power. The regent and the young king, who was a child, escaped from Baghdad to Transjordan and took refuge with the Emir Abdullah, who was the regent's uncle. And the four generals who had carried out this coup d'etat declared war on Britain and appealed for assistance to Germany. There was a British RAF camp on the Euphrates, on the edge of the desert, the Syrian desert, which divided the Euphrates from Transjordan. That was a place called Habania. They were all RAF, no ground troops, except the RAF regiment, who were intended to be aerodrome guards only. And the Iraqi army immediately marched out of Baghdad and besieged Habania. There were virtually no troops because the British army in Egypt was fighting in the western desert. However, they raised a column which consisted of a regiment of lifeguards, which had also been hastily put into commercial trucks because they arrived on black horses, and one battalion of infantry, the Essex Regiment, and I think one battery of field artillery, I'm not quite sure. And they asked our newly raised mechanized regiment to accompany this column in order to relieve Habania, which was besieged. This meant crossing 450 to 500 miles of desert. Ours was a comparatively small contingent. We had about 350 men. And as I say, the British Army had a regiment of cavalry in pickups and a battalion of infantry. We led the column across the desert. And actually, they would never have got to Habania without us, not because we fought so well, but because they all got stuck in the sand. And it was only, in fact, when almost within reach of the besieged camp of Habania, they decided that they'd have to go back. They couldn't get through. However, we pointed out that we would lead them through. If you've driven a lot in the desert, you know that the beds of wadis are usually firm soil because the water flows down there when it rains, whereas the tops of ridges are often very sandy and loose. Well, the British had tried to take a compass bearing and drive straight in, you see, and they'd all got bogged axle deep in the sand. So we extracted them by showing them what desert soil was like and where to go. And eventually we arrived and relieved Habania. Meanwhile, a division from India had landed in Basra. From Habania, our column went on to attack Baghdad. And again, we crossed the Euphrates. And over there is a large piece of desert between the Euphrates and the Tigris above Baghdad. And we crossed this up to the Tigris. This had, I think, more effect really than it deserved, because it appeared to the people in Baghdad that we were going to surround them. There were troops coming up from Basra, and we had got not only coming from the west, we were immediately north of them on the Tigris. And I think that hastened their collapse.
You mean you weren't very strong, but they thought that you might be stronger.
Well, they didn't know exactly how much we were, but they actually tried to withdraw a battalion or something of their troops from Mosul. And it failed to get through. It arrived on a train down the railway from Mosul to Baghdad. And we were able to shoot up this train, make it go back. And that rather scared them, I think. Then we were fighting in a desultory manner, because we had so few men in the date gardens north of Baghdad, whereas the Essex Regiment and a squadron of lifeguards, I think, approached Baghdad from the west. Anyhow, after a month or so of various hostilities, the four generals and their supporters escaped from Baghdad to Persia, Iran, and Baghdad surrendered. And we provided an escort for the regent and the king to return to their capital. Meanwhile, the British embassy had been besieged, so they were quite pleased to see us too. We collected quite a number of Iraq army, who of course were under orders. They probably were not particularly sympathetic with the coup d'etat people, but as soon as the regent and the king arrived, we formed an escort of their own army to accompany them and made our entry into Baghdad.
Why do you think it was that the British force that was making its way to relieve Habania didn't consult you in the Arab Legion about the techniques of crossing the desert when you were the experts in the area? Was it because it was all such a rush job?
No. When we first joined this column, they looked upon us rather askance. Local natives sort of business, you see. When we said we'd provide the advance guard, they said, fine, well, you go right on ahead there, you see, and didn't place much reliance upon us. It was only when they got stuck, when even then they did not think of asking us what they should do. But, of course, I was able to visit the commander of the column and his people and so on. And when they said they'd have to go back, I was able to say, well, look here, it's really quite unnecessary. We can show you the way. And that was the first time they really took much interest in us or placed any reliance on us at all. Thereafter, they came to rely on us very much. And we all worked in splendidly. They took our advice because they realized, after all, it was the native country of our people.
What other work was the Arab Legion involved in the Second World War period?
Well, the next thing after this, after the fall of Baghdad, we came back, our little regiment, to Amman. But then General Wavell decided that before German aircraft had arrived in Syria, meanwhile, and operated against us when we were marching on Baghdad. We used to get shot up by Messerschmitts. But there'd been no time or method of getting German troops into Syria. But there was no doubt that they proposed to come. They'd just taken Crete. Consequently, General Wavell decided it would be better to clean up Syria before German ground troops could arrive. And he scraped a few troops from Egypt, and we invaded Syria, in which we were also assisted by the Free French, because meanwhile General de Gaulle had come over to Britain and was collecting what French he could to fight on with Britain. So there was the British Army, part of whom were Australians, an Australian division from Egypt, and the Free French. And the British and the French moved up along the Mediterranean coast towards Beirut and towards Damascus in the normal settled areas. But Palmyra is an oasis in the middle of the desert, northeast of Damascus. And our column, which had gone to Baghdad, was reformed and told to go round the desert flank, that is, up to the east flank of our advance, and take Palmyra. Palmyra was more or less behind Damascus. And if Palmyra were taken, you could drive into Homs, which is actually on the lines of communication of Damascus. And so it was thought a turning movement through the desert would get the French out of the Damascus-Beirut line more quickly. So we rejoined our column of the Essex Regiment and the Life Guards and drove up through the desert and attacked Palmyra. Actually, Palmyra had been very strongly fortified. It was full of concrete pillboxes and all sorts of things. And the people who fought best, ironically enough, was the French Foreign Legion, the majority of whom were Germans.